They are not of the world, as I am not of the world. Sanctify them by the truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, I also have sent them into the world. I sanctify myself for them, so they also may be sanctified by the truth. Jesus prayed that we might be unified in his truth, standing firm in the faith and strong in his word. In a world questioning the credibility of God's word, Christ's prayer is for his church to stand firm in unity and his word. This is The Answers Conversation, and I'm your host, Steve Hamm. We'll be answering the skeptical questions of our time, standing firm on the authority of God's word, and rejoicing in the gospel of Jesus Christ. Well, we're continuing our theology series as we look at the foundational history in Genesis and how it has the importance of giving us coherency for all of the rest of Christian doctrine. And of course, we're not looking at every one of the Christian doctrines. We obviously don't have years and years to go through this series, but we've just picked out a select few and are talking about how some of these doctrines that we have in the church have their foundational history for coherency in Genesis, and there is always a Genesis link to a doctrine. With us today, we have Lee Anderson, and Lee has a Master's of Arts in Theology from Master's College, and he is an integral part of our research team here at Answers in Genesis. It's great to have you with us, Lee.
Oh, thanks. It's good to be back with you again.
Yeah, great. And, you know, we're going to be talking about an interesting topic here, and we might actually do this over a couple of programs. So if you're listening today, you have to listen to next week as well. But we're going to be talking about the doctrine of the church, but even as it is related to marriage, and how that is reflected in Genesis. So a little bit of ecclesiology, I suppose, today, the doctrine of the church. So, you know, let's start things off, Lee, and let me just ask you, in relation to the early chapters of Genesis, how would you say that they are related to the doctrine of ecclesiology, the church?
Okay, well, in the early chapters of Genesis, of course, we don't see the doctrine of the church presented explicitly. As a matter of fact, even going throughout the entirety of the Old Testament, you could probably say we don't see the doctrine of the church presented explicitly. But what we do see in Genesis is the beginning or the origin of certain themes that are extremely significant later on when we're constructing the doctrine of ecclesiology. When we look at the doctrine of the church and we see some of those things that are extremely important to it, we can trace those back to Genesis. Now, of course, in Genesis 1 and 2, where we're going to be looking today, we don't see things like the qualifications for elders or deacons. We don't see things like the instructions for the Lord's Supper or baptism. We don't see specifics like that, but we see some things that are very general, and we see some things that are going to be important later on. And the one that I think we wanted to talk about today was specifically marriage.
You think that is the most central theme?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think, though, whether or not we call it the most central theme, it's definitely a dominant one.
Right, in Genesis. And that's probably what I was really meaning, is that the most dominant characteristic that is coming out that is related to the church?
Yeah, I would say so. Marriage is probably the most significant theme, or at least the most visible one that we see that later gets tied with the church. And of course, we'll get to this later, but in Ephesians chapter 5, we have a very direct link between the early chapters of Genesis and the doctrine of the church, where the Apostle Paul is quoting verbatim Genesis 2:24.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you look at Paul, he's doing this. He's going back to Genesis 2:24. And when he's talking about men and women in the church in 1 Corinthians 11, he goes back to Genesis 2 also, talking about Adam being created first and then Eve. And then also you see Jesus in respect of marriage, and we're talking about marriage and the church today,
yeah,
who is also talking about that in Mark 10 and Matthew 19, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does that, and not only are these three men that you've mentioned doing that, we see that with some of the other apostles as well. We see John, who's not talking about marriage in the church, but he is tying a lot of his theology back to themes that have their origin in Genesis. Peter is doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. That is the tone in the New Testament, to trace doctrines back to their beginning.
So they're making these incredible links, and we also see in relation to the church, there's a link with marriage. And so we're going to take a couple of programs to really get there and talk about it. But let's go back to Genesis first, and let's talk about, for instance, Genesis 1, 26 to 28, because often in these verses about being created in the image of God, there are some really important things to see. So how would you say even these verses provide a foundation for our understanding of marriage?
Okay, thanks, Steve. I'm really glad that you went back that far. There's a lot more to this link than simply going from Genesis 2:24 directly to Ephesians 5. There's a lot of other things to bring in, and one of those things is the foundation for marriage that we see in Genesis 1:26-28. Now, these three verses are extremely crucial to the theological outlook of the Pentateuch. So it seems prudent that we start here and that we could read it for our audience. In Genesis 1:26-28, it says, "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over all the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth.' Then God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. God blessed them, and God said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over every living thing that moves on the earth.'" That's just an incredible theological statement that's pregnant with meaning.
It is. Every time actually somebody reads those words, I just get this shiver just thinking of how special they are. I mean, we shouldn't just skim over those words, should we? I mean, we look at these words and they are telling us that we're created in the image of our Creator. That is just incredible stuff.
Yeah, actually, Eugene Merrill, if I could paraphrase him, mm-hmm. when he was looking at the theology of the Pentateuch, he said, if you don't get these three verses, you're going to have major problems with understanding everything else in the five books of Moses.
Wow. Okay, so they are big deal verses.
Yes, they are big deal verses. But we see in them a few things that are relevant for our purposes here. First of all, we see both man and woman that are created in the image of God. In other words, they're created ontologically equal. They're both sharers in the divine image. Mm. And that creates a basis for a complementary function within marriage. It's not, you know, between one man who's created in the image of God and one woman who is not. They're on the same plane before their Creator, both sharing the divine image. Mm. And this union, of course, as we see, is blessed by God with a view to the continuation of the human race and for the benefit of the whole of creation. We see these imperatives: be fruitful, multiply, fill, subdue, rule. God has in view a function for mankind that relates to the whole of creation. And one other thing that I find really significant here that impacts our understanding of marriage, and then, of course, we'll see how that plays into ecclesiology later. Mm-hmm. But for our purposes right now, looking at marriage, we go through all of Genesis 1, and we see the creation of various life forms. We see the creation of flying things, of swimming things, of land creatures, creeping things. Mm-hmm. And there's no big deal made about gender distinction between them. We just have the creation of animals. With mankind specifically, we have a very direct note about gender distinction, and that really highlights the special place given to human sexuality. It's a gift from God, and it's to be guarded from abuse. Right. The very fact that the author here saw fit to mention that underlines its importance.
Yeah.
And so this passage as a whole, if we could just sum up here in these three verses, it sets the parameters for marriage. We see here it's a solemn joining of two image bearers for accomplishing a distinctive God-ordained purpose.
And, okay, let me ask you about this purpose a little bit, because seriously, you have this statement to them is fill and multiply across the earth. You know, and they're in this one central place in this Garden of Eden that God put them in, the special garden that he had given them. And from there they were to fill and multiply, you know, multiply across the earth and fill it and have dominion over it, really reflecting his glory, right?
Oh, absolutely. Man has a responsibility before his creator to carry out the creator's instructions, and that, of course, will, as a result, magnify the creator's glory.
Yeah, as the waters cover the sea, cover the lands with the glory of God. I have my own reflection here on this, just thinking about the church, because we're going to go back to the church quite often. But I want to ask you this question. When Jesus says to us to go out to every tribe, tongue, and nation with the gospel of Jesus Christ, is not that doing a similar thing to what Adam and Eve were supposed to do in the Garden of Eden, which is fill the whole lands with the glory of God?
Yes, when we think about the focus here being on the glory of God and mankind's responsibility then in Genesis to magnify the glory of God in the new creation, and now the church's responsibility to magnify the glory of God by going out to the nations, by proclaiming the gospel, yes, it's similar. It's accomplished in a different way, of course.
Yes.
But yes, there is a similarity there. And the scope of the mission, so to speak, is just as broad.
Yeah,
it's the whole earth.
It's the whole earth, which is just absolutely fantastic. Okay, well, you were mentioning to me that Genesis 1, 26 to 28 has obvious themes that are familiar in Genesis 2, 18 to 24 as well. But 18 to 24 expand on what we've already read. How's that?
Yeah, this is an elaboration, of course. And we've talked before, I think you and I have talked before, and certainly other people that have interviewed with you before, they have talked about that Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, there really is no contradiction, as some of the liberal critics have claimed. Genesis 1 is a very broad overview of creation, mm-hmm. and Genesis 2 is honing in on a specific aspect of that creation account, the creation of mankind specifically. So we have Genesis 1, which is the broader picture of creation in 6 days, and Genesis 2, we're narrowing our focus to talk about some of the specifics of what happened on day 6. But what's very important here is that we see some elaboration on the themes in Genesis 1. Having made the man, Adam, the Lord announces in Genesis 2:18 that it's not good for man to be alone, which is a marked departure from the sevenfold refrain that we see in chapter 1. God keeps saying, it's good, and in the end he concludes, it's very good.
Yep.
And this hints at the significance of the act that is to come. God's determination to make man a helper corresponding to him, that is foreshadowed by God saying, something's not right, this is
right.
Not good.
Yep.
And so we see there, there's the intent of God to do something, and what does he do? He makes Adam a helper, a wife for him. And the woman's function as the helper here is by no means demeaning at all. The word for helper in the Old Testament is commonly used of God himself. We see that in Exodus 18 and Deuteronomy 33 and 1 Samuel 7 and in the Psalms as well. So there's no contradiction with Genesis 1 where we see man and woman created as ontologically equal. But here in Genesis 2, it's supplemented by the idea that they have differences in their function,
yeah.
A woman being created as man's helper.
But they correspond, you know, Adam's not getting somebody that is opposite to him, he's getting somebody who's fitted for him. He's getting somebody who is fitting, you know, to be complementary with him.
Yes, Alan Ross highlighted this, and he said it very succinctly, that the word helper here emphasizes that the woman is the one who provides what is lacking in man. She's there to complement him.
And on that, we're going to finish this program because we just wanted to set this foundation that we're looking at the aspects of marriage, which we'll expand upon in the next session as we see this through the Bible, how these aspects end up being a wonderful picture of the church and link the doctrine that has its foundational history in Genesis to what we see in the church and what it's meant to be, and how marriage reflects that. Thank you very much, Lee. If you want answers on this or any other subject, visit answersingenesis.org. That's answersingenesis.org.